And hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. And today is Wednesday, May 9th, 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are Steve Weinberg and Jack L. High in the first half and Julie Metz in the second half. First up, Steve Weinberg and Jack L. High. Jack is the author of The Lobotomist, A Maverick Medical Genius and His Tragic Quest to Rid the World of Mental Illness, which was adapted into a PBS American Experience TV documentary and is currently in the works as a TV series pilot for HBO. His next biography, The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, forthcoming from Public Affairs Books, tells the story of the calamitous results of physician Douglas Kelly's search for the essence of evil as the U.S. Army psychiatrist assigned to treat and study the top Nazi war criminals on trial in Nuremberg. He's a past president of the American Society of Journalists and Authors and recently joined the faculty of a new low-residency MFA program in creative writing that will launch in 2013 at Augsburg College in Minneapolis, and he will be at the third annual Complete Biographers Conference at USC in Los Angeles next weekend, May 18th to 20th, and we'll talk a bit more about that. Steve Weinberg's books include a biography of Armand Hammer from Little Brown in 1989, A Guide to Reading and Writing Biography from the University of Missouri Press, 1992, The Reporter's Handbook, An Investigator's Guide to Documents and Techniques, published by St. Martin's Press and commissioned by Investigative Reporters and Editors, 1996, and a dual biography of Ida Tarbell and John D. Rockefeller, published by Norton in 2008. Today, Steve supplements his book writing with freelance magazine articles, features, newspaper op-ed pieces, and book reviews, and he joined the Missouri School of Journalism faculty in 1978. Hello, you two. Are you there?
Yes.
Good to be here, Barbara.
All right. I have you both. This is a technical marvel right now. let's begin with each of you talking about how you became interested in writing biography. Jack, do you want to begin?
Sure. Well, I have to say that I got into it without any particular planning and by accident. I became a biographer in the mid to late 1990s when I simply heard a story that was interesting to me. It was the story that a woman here in the Twin Cities of Minnesota where I lived, she told me a story about her uncle. And this uncle had been a patient in the state hospital system in Minnesota and had received a lobotomy during his time as a patient with some pretty terrible results. And I heard his story and got interested in the topic of lobotomy, but quite soon I realized that there was a person behind the story of lobotomy and that this person was more intriguing to me than anybody else, patient or physician, who I had come across involved in the story. His name was Walter Freeman. He was a psychiatrist and neurologist. And I began following Dr. Freeman's trail. And that is really how I became a biographer. I wrote a couple of articles about Dr. Freeman's lobotomy practice and then the book The Lobotomist in 2005.
And before that, what were you focused on?
I was focused on everything. I was a general interest writer. I was writing on a lot of things, writing on history, writing on the arts and music in particular, writing a lot of profiles. And it was really finding out about Dr. Freeman's work and the experiences of lobotomy patients that sent me down the path that I've followed ever since. And since then, I have been writing quite a bit about the history of psychiatry and science.
Okay, great. How about you, Steve?
I always planned to write books. I planned the progression from newspaper writing to magazine writing to book writing, and it actually worked out. And biography seemed like a natural fit for me because I'm curious about other human beings.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm I understand the aspect of, you know, the point at which you become fascinated with a person's life or story. But what happens next in terms of how do you discover whether it's a good idea to pursue that person as subject matter in terms of has he or she been covered too much? Is there enough interest from readers, et cetera? Where do you go from the initial interest?
Well, it's definitely an art, not a science. If you're going to try to make a living as an author of serious works, biography or otherwise, you've obviously got to find publishers or other financial backers. So there is certainly a commercial aspect to choosing subjects. But I would never want to write a biography of someone who'd been done over and over, even if there was a lot of money in it. I mean, I could become, you know, the 55th biographer of Marilyn Monroe or whatever the count is up to now. But I wouldn't enjoy that. So I always try to look for subjects where I can break new ground and also, you know, maybe make enough money to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing that plays into it for many biographers is the element of obsession. That many of us write best on the figures who we cannot get out of our heads for one reason or another. So in my case, and I may be a little different from Steve in this sense, I probably could write the 56th biography of Marilyn Monroe if I were sufficiently obsessed by her. I'm not. Or I could write about a figure like Abraham Lincoln or Napoleon, people who have had hundreds of biographies written on them. Writing a biography takes so long and takes so much work and so much research that if there isn't that obsession to carry you along, personal, deep interest, then I don't think you'll go far regardless of how famous or obscure your subject is.
Mm-hmm. Actually a question for each of you. For you, Jack, talk about how The Lobotomist became a PBS documentary and is now becoming a TV pilot. I mean, is that something you did, or
grand master plan to that happening? There wasn't. I think one thing that happened with The Lobotomist is that it unearthed a storyline that was of interest to a lot of people, and it was a dramatic storyline about patients in great need of help and a doctor with a solution, not a cure, but a possible solution, and how things went wrong. And a lot of people were interested in that storyline. And so word about The Lobotomist got out there in a lot of different ways. There was in addition to my book, soon after it was published, I assisted on a NPR, All Things Considered, radio documentary about one of Freeman's patients. So a lot of people heard that. And I think the production people at American Experience heard that, and that's probably what led them to me. So one evening, I just got an email out of the blue from the person who ended up being co-director of the film, asking me if I would be interested in having my book adapted. And the HBO program was in the works in various forms for many years. It took a long time together, but there wasn't anything that I did in particular to make it happen. I think the book was out there. The producers who were interested saw it and got their hands on it. They were working on a film on a kind of related topic, Shutter Island, and mm-hmm. had gotten a hold of my book. And that is what led them to me.
Interesting. Okay. And Steve, I was curious about something I read about you or in your bio somewhere. You said you started in newspaper newsrooms, moved to magazines so you could write longer features, and then shifted to book writing with longer word counts. And now you also write short form again. Could you talk about that, going from short to long to short and everything in between?
Well, I've only gone back a short part of the time because I have to. if I could make my living writing only books, I would.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a few years when I did make my living writing books, but normally I've had to supplement to book writing. I believe that, you know, time equals truth,
mm-hmm.
and also having enough words helps equal truth, and book writing is just what I'm more comfortable with. I knew in my early years of journalism that many journalists, I would say maybe even most journalists, are in need of instant gratification, and I'm not one of them, fortunately. So I paid my dues and, you know, worked on newspapers where I had to write pieces hurriedly, but I never found that very satisfying, and I really want to find something approximating the truth, and books are the best vehicle for that. By the way, that time equals truth saying comes from Robert Caro, who may be the best-known biographer of our era.
Hmm.
I borrowed that from him with his permission.
Hmm. I like that. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm with biographers Steve Weinberg and Jack L. High. Okay, so you mentioned sort of, both of you have mentioned the marketplace, and talk a little bit about that. I mean, has it changed? Is there as much interest in biographies as there has been? Has the interest shifted to celebrity biographies more than your, I don't know, typical notable, if there is such a thing? I mean, you know, what should writers be thinking about in terms of if they're considering writing a biography, whether it's actually a viable, you know, avenue to pursue, or should you just, again, get back to whatever your passion is and do that and worry about the money later?
Well, and anybody who plans to make a lot of money writing serious books, whether they're biography or other topics, should not plan on that. Most books lose money for everybody involved. And it's just a reality, and it's probably never going to change. So I feel fortunate if I can just simply support myself and my loved ones during the duration of a book and never expect to have anything saved afterwards. It just doesn't happen very often. So, yes, you have to think commercially, but you also have to think realistically within that commercial thinking. And, you know, if you walk into either a Barnes & Noble superstore or even, you know, the best independent bookstore in your town, the ones I prefer, of course, 95% of the books you see there, what are called trade books, mm-hmm. are going to lose money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the other 5%. Those are rough percentages, of course. The other 5% carry the 95%.
Mm-hmm.
So I pray every night to people like Stephen King. I may not take all of his books, and movies are great, but he's the reason publishers can support money losing authors mm-hmm. like myself.
Interesting point. I can just see you praying for Stephen King. It's like, please.
There are a couple of things that I think of biography market. One is that I think it's relatively healthy compared with other categories. That if you look at
Jack, I'm having a hard time hearing you. I don't. Are you Steve? Can you hear Jack?
I can hear you fine, but Jack's voice is breaking up.
Yeah, Jack's voice is breaking up.
I'll try not to break up. Do I sound any better now?
No, unfortunately.
I sound like a robot.
Or that you have one of those little voice things stuck in your throat because you lost your voice. Do you know what I mean? It's like...
Yeah, not good. I don't want to sound auto-tuned.
Let me think on that for a second and see if there's anything we can do on this end. I don't know what we can do, but... maybe you could try calling me back?
I will do that. I'll do that right now.
In the meantime, Steve.
Yes.
You were talking about financing?
Yes.
And I know there's a panel at the Biographers Conference next weekend called Financing the Project. And I see there are grants and fellowships for biography projects, and it hadn't occurred to me that that would be the case. Are they easy or difficult to get?
Well, there are not very many specifically for biography. There are a couple, but there are quite a few grants and fellowships for serious writers, and I mean for fiction writers too. I just don't happen to live in the fiction world, so I don't know about those grants quite as well. But for instance, on you mentioned the dual biography I did of Ida Tarbell and John D. Rockefeller, a grant that I got from an organization called the.
Hello.
I'm here.
We have Jack, and we lost Steve. Anyway, so this is how it goes sometimes when you have more than one person on the air. So hopefully Steve will call back. The biographer.
I can go back to the point that I was making
before.
I turned into a robot, and that was about the market for biography.
Yes,
and that I was saying that it seems relatively healthy compared with other nonfiction categories. You see a lot of biographies on the bestseller lists, and one very notable aspect I think of the biography market is that it includes men in large numbers as
mm-hmm.
readers,
mm-hmm.
which is certainly not true with most other. Categories, fiction or nonfiction.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, my husband reads biographies, and I mean, usually people in the music business, but it's always biographies, and he'll get into a, you know, he may get into a novel, but he usually puts it down and picks up a biography that's come in. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that. And what about financing? We were talking about that, Steve and I, before after you turned into a robot, because there's a panel at the Biographers Conference next weekend that's I forget what it's called, but it's about financing a project through grants and fellowships and everything else. Can you talk a little about that while I get Steve back on the line?
Sure, sure. I have always financed my book projects by doing other work at the same time and not by getting grants and fellowships. The kinds of projects that I work on, stories of renegade psychiatrists, etc., don't really seem to excite the interest of the people who give grants and fellowships.
What do
so,
they want?
Like Steve, what I have done is to as I'm working on a book, to be working on other projects. Sometimes there are other books. I've done over the years a number of commissioned corporate histories, and then I also do articles and shorter pieces. So financing a book project of any kind, but especially a biography, which can take a long time to research and write,
mm-hmm.
is quite a juggling act. You know, as we all know, advances are not what they used to be for books. So the amount that you get, the amount of money you get up front from the publisher, is often not enough to sustain you for
mm-hmm.
the amount of time you'll be putting the book together.
Hmm.
By the way, there is a solution to that that's used in a lot of other countries, especially throughout Europe, which is authors getting money from library lending rights. You know, in a lot of countries, every time a reader checks a book out of the library, the author gets a small royalty.
Hmm.
And of course, being a self-interested author, I would love to see that happen in this country, but I don't think it's even on anybody's agenda.
Well, that's interesting. It should be on somebody's agenda.
Yeah, well, my congressman doesn't listen to me, I'll tell you that.
Well, what were you saying about financing projects when you so rudely got disconnected? Steve.
What was I saying?
Yeah, you were talking about financing, you know, about grants and fellowships and such.
Well the biographers group that you mentioned is meeting in Southern California next week, it's trying to develop some grants and other awards for biographers. There's already one established Center for Biography in New York City at one of the universities there that gives some fellowships. I think it's more New York City oriented, although I'm not sure of that. So there are some possibilities out there, but like I said, you just can't count on them. And I don't ever like to whine about this. I mean, Jack chose to be an author. I chose to be an author.
Mm-hmm.
We knew what we were getting into, more or less, at least the financial part. And I just feel privileged to be able to write the books I want to write at least some of the time, even though I'm not making money on them. And I feel when I'm done that they're like my children. I mean, I love all of my books just like I love all of my biological children. And books are special. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love my books more than I love my magazine articles. They take longer. They're prettier. You know, they're just very special. So I try not to whine about it. But if anyone wants to advocate and pass library lending rights, I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
To that, I would add, not only are books special, but I think biography is a special category of book from the writing end, because what we do is spend a long time sifting somebody else's life and reflecting on it and trying to make sense of it. And this is something that we usually don't even have a chance to do with our own lives. And I think in some ways we get to know our subjects better, or at least more deeply in some sense, than did the people who knew our subject or were their children or family members.
Mm-hmm.
And in one upshot of that whole process is that it becomes not just a reflection on somebody else's life, but an investigation of what is important to us, and it turns into, in my experience anyway, an examination of my own life often.
Hmm. Jack, take a minute, because we are at the end of our time. Talk about your panel that's going to be at the Biographers Conference next weekend.
Glad to. So this is all happening on the campus of USC at the Davidson Center there. My panel will be on Saturday, May 19th, which is the day of the full conference going on. It'll be at 9 a.m., and it's called The Biographer and the Biopic. So we have on the panel a distinguished group of four screenwriters who will be talking about what goes into writing a successful biographical film or TV movie. And the people on the panel, it's a great group. There's Bill Wheeler, who has written screenplays for Disney and HBO. He wrote a film called The Hoax, and another film that's being shot now called The Reluctant Fundamentalist. I'll be very excited to see there a screenwriter and producer named Margaret Nagel, who's been nominated for two Emmys and won two Writers Guild of America awards. And then a team, screenwriting team, Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, who were the screenwriters behind the films The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, the Chronicles of Narnia films, Captain America, The First Avenger, and its forthcoming sequel. And they're going to be doing a lot of reflecting on how do you present a life on the screen, and how is that different from the lives that Steve and I present and other biographers present in our pages, and how do you move back and forth from one to the other?
Mm. That sounds great, and we are out of time, and maybe if both of you agree to it, I can send you questions, and we can continue this on the blog a little bit for listeners who I'm sure have more that they'd love to know about writing biography.
That'll be fine.
Okay.
Absolutely.
You each have websites, yeah?
Yes.
So steveweinberg.com and...
No, steveweinbergauthor.com.
Okay, steveweinbergauthor.com and jackelhai.com?
It's simply elhai.com, E-L-H-A-I.com.
And I think also if you look up The Lobotomist...
Yes, that will get you to that book's website, which is lobotomist.com.
Okay. Thank you so much, both of you, for taking the time.
Thanks, Barbara.
That was Jack Elhai and Steve Weinberg, and they are both esteemed biographers. They're both members of the American Society of Journalists and Authors, which is how I knew them, and their websites are great and worth looking into, and as I said... we'll continue this on the blog, penonfire.blogspot.com, in the next week or two. So I have so many more questions to ask them, and we need to take a break, though, and prepare for our next guest, Julie Metz, who is a memoirist. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this little musical interlude. Thank you.
baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
I lost my mojo.
You lost it?
I lost it.
Where'd it go?
I don't know, but I found it. I found it on Writers on Writing.
Writers on Writing?
Wednesday mornings at 9. 9 a.m. in the morning.
With Barbara DeMarco Barrett and Marie Stone?
That's them.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We were on the last half with Steve Weinberg and Jack L. High, who are biographers, and had a little bit of technical difficulties that we resolved, but had so many more questions for those guys that I am going to follow up with on the blog. So do check out penonfire.blogspot.com in the next week or so. And as well, podcasts are posted there. And this show, along with many others, will be podcasts so that you can listen again or direct your friends around the world to listen to the shows at any time during the day. We are back, and my next guest is Julie Metz. She's a writer, graphic designer, and artist, the recipient of a McDowell Fellowship. She has written for publications including the New York Times, Glamour, Family.com, Hemispheres, Family Circle, and MrBeller'sNeighborhood.com. Perfection, a memoir of betrayal and renewal, published by Harper Perennial Voice, is the book she'll be talking about with us today. It's a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers selection and a New York Times bestseller. Let's bring her on. Hi, Julie.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Good to have you on the show.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Let's begin by hearing you tell us a little bit about the book and how it came to be.
I started the book in the period immediately following the events that happened, right after my husband died in 2003, and I had started really keeping with a lot of correspondence with friends. I lived in a small town, and I started writing emails to friends who were sort of looking, you know, wanted to keep in touch with me. And that's really how it began, was sort of almost as a diary that I was kind of writing for myself and something that I sent to a few friends. And then I found that process was provided a kind of comfort especially when things really started to develop 6 months later, with sort of the very dramatic, you know, following the first very dramatic event, which is his sudden death, came, you know, the discovery that he had been leading a very secret life and had had numerous affairs. And when that came out, I found that this writing process, whether it was writing to friends or keeping the journal for myself, became something I really leaned on.
Mm-hmm. And then how did it go from there? Did you put a book proposal together, or did you write a draft, or and then decide, you know, to look for an agent, or how did that go?
Well, I would say I'm smiling because my particular experience is probably not the usual one for many writers. As it happened, my husband was a writer, and at the time of his death, he was under contract and had an agent. And again, this process sort of meandered along with me writing really something that was just for myself. But by the end of that year, I started talking to his agent. Well, first I had wanted to finish his book for him after the revelations of all the affairs came out. I wasn't as interested in doing that as you can imagine.
I guess not.
And so I started thinking about this thing that was happening to me, and how I imagined, even then, I thought there must be a lot of women who are going through something like this. And I started thinking and talking to my husband's agent, who wanted to work with me to develop something. So that, in a way, I sort of inherited an agent before I'd written a proposal, really, or really gathered everything up in anything that was presentable. Then came a long process of shaping the material into a proposal, and, you know, for all the writers out there, I'll just say it took a few tries to get it right. And I think these things tend to come in threes, you know, like all the journeys, the hard journeys of life. The third time was the charm. So it did take a lot of work, really about a year, to get it into shape to send out, you know, for my agent to send out.
Mm-hmm. So. You know, in reading this, I, you know, I noticed that you change names and such, as you said in the disclaimer at the beginning of the book. But how many details did you need to change in terms of job, family, you know, hair color? I mean, how detailed was the writing in terms of, or the details in terms of changing, so that perhaps the people you were writing about might recognize themselves, but nobody else would?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I wanted very much to be protective of the people in the story, especially I wanted to be protective of some of the people that were perhaps had, you would think I would have the least compassion for. But I did feel very strongly that they should be hidden to the best of my ability. In the situation that I was in, all these people were known within the community that I lived in, so it wasn't about hiding. You know, they couldn't be hidden there. But I felt that really what I was trying to do was tell a story and not expose people further who might not wish to be exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was I changed everybody's names. I tried to retain, I guess, what you'd call the telling details, you know, that illuminate character and personality, but not so much worry about physical appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And where I could omit something like that, I did. There's a few occasions where I deliberately altered people's physical appearance, just because I felt that maintaining some privacy for those people was important,
mm-hmm.
and that was the only way to do it. But in a lot of cases, I found that it wasn't necessary to describe people physically, and that therefore, you know, they could be anybody.
Right.
It was more about who they were and not what they looked like.
And yet, I'm assuming that some of the women you discuss, especially one in particular, would recognize themselves, you know, no matter how many details were changed. And so I'm curious if you worried at any point about offending them. I mean, you know, you made them non-recognizable, but in terms of sort of the essence of who they were and what they did, I'm sure they know, you know, in reading your book, and I'm sure they read your book, that was them. So what did you do with that worry, if there was one, or you know, were, at that point, was there no worry about, you know, what you were writing about?
Well, I think there's always worry in situations like this, and, you know, I remember reading a quote while I was working that I've kind of kept on my desktop, which is that unless you sort of feel like the gist of it being that, you know, unless you feel like you're taking it over the edge, you probably aren't quite there yet,
mm-hmm.
you know. But what I, again, what I felt, the people were all known within the community. So, you know, the woman that you might be thinking of,
mm-hmm.
Character Kathy,
right.
I mean, everyone knew who she was already and what she had done. So that I didn't have to, that was almost like, you know, within the small town I lived in, it was she was a public personality, so to speak, already, in that way. But I felt again that I could describe the person, a character, and what actions, you know, this person had taken without physically describing her,
mm-hmm.
so that she was just a personality or a type, you
right.
know, that you might encounter in your life without identifying her physically.
Mm-hmm.
I was careful to hide certain things about her, about the house she lived in, about what she did for a living, because I had no interest in
right.
destroying her ability to earn a living.
Right.
You know, so I wasn't interested in that at all. I was just interested in telling the story and representing her character.
Mm-hmm. Will you read to us from Perfection?
Yes.
That'd
be great. I thought that what I'd read today would just be the very opening pages,
mm-hmm.
Just because it's I wouldn't have to. It sets up the story, and then I think that's often what I read when I did public readings.
Okay.
So I will start there. January 8th, 2003. It happened like this. Henry's footsteps on the old wooden floorboards, the toilet flushing, more footsteps, perhaps on the stairs. Silence. Then the thud. I was working downstairs in my office on a bitterly cold Wednesday afternoon. My workspace was an enclosed sun porch off our living room, the small paned windows on three sides framing a view of the snowy hills across the road. Wrapped in a shawl, wearing fuzzy socks on my chilled feet, I continued studying the project on my computer screen. At 43, I had been a graphic designer for nearly 20 years, a freelancer specializing in cover designs for book publishers. Today's project was a novel about hard luck cowboys, due yesterday as always. I stopped fiddling with type design possibilities as I glanced at the computer clock. In an hour, I would have to make a dash out to the car to pick up our 6.5-year-old daughter, Liza, just before school let out at 3:10. Henry had been sick in bed all morning. There would be the freezing cold wait and the daily social milling with the other mothers on the school playground, then the quick drive home to finish my work. I'd wear my new sheepskin coat today and feel guilty about its expense on a warmer day. On second thought, the distressed sans-serif type worked better with the moody image of a cowboy leaning against a split-rail fence. Suddenly, my brain rewound sharply. It wasn't a package dropped outside by the UPS guy. My office phone rang. Instinctively, I answered. The photographer on the line asked me how I liked the images he had emailed. It wasn't the cats knocking groceries off the kitchen counter. I can't talk now, Something bad is happening. I ended the call abruptly. The rooms were silent as I ran up the stairs calling for Henry. Two of our four cats skittered out of my way, their nails clawing the wooden treads. The bedroom was empty. I raced back down the stairs. I found Henry on his back, spread-eagled on the kitchen floor, his head a few inches from the oven broiler. He was still breathing. His body was silhouetted against the sea blue of the painted floorboards. I imagined a police chalk drawing of the outline of the victim at a crime scene. I was overwhelmed with the feeling that I was in the scene and watching a scene on television, an opening sequence of an episode of 6 Feet Under, our favorite show that year. Usually some minor character dies in the first 5 minutes. And Henry inhaled with a shallow breath, small dribbles of saliva on his curved lips, the skin on his face now sallow and ashen. He exhaled with a feeble sigh. His eyes flickered half open. I spoke to him to let him know that I was there with him, but for once in our life together, he could not speak back.
Thank you.
Shall I stop there?
Yeah, let's stop there so we have a bit more time to talk, because it's such a powerful opening. And I am, well, first of all, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and that was Julie Metz reading from the opening of Perfection, a memoir of betrayal and renewal. It's such a powerful opening. Was that there at the beginning? Did the book start there when you started the book, or at what point did you write that opening?
You know, I would say that the first few sentences, coming up with sort of knowing where to begin was really the hardest part of this whole writing project for me, and I really appreciate this difficulty now because I'm working on another book, and it's the same thing all over again. But I would say that an opening is so important, never more so than now. I think we have, you know, readership with increasingly short attention spans, and you really, really do need to kind of capture them. It's not like bombs have to drop and, you know, there has to be catastrophe, but something has to engage the reader pretty quickly. In the end, those opening lines came when, after many frustrating attempts to write an opening, I was describing it to my boyfriend, and I was saying, you know, it was like this. It happened like this. And he said, just do that. Just write it like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did.
Interesting.
As if I was telling a story. I thought I'll just take the reader right away and make them feel, if I can, as if I'm they're going with me. On the journey.
Yeah, real powerful first pages. A question came in from a listener of the program, and she said, you obviously love and cared much for your daughter after her father's death. Was it difficult to expose her through the story during the writing process, given your husband's transgressions? Meaning, did you worry about her classmates or others, now probably teens, how they would look unfavorably on her, or how this would affect her view of herself via her memories of her dad?
Well, that's a good question, and I would say that the only thing I really ever worried about in writing this book and publishing it was my daughter. I think that there are few books like mine because people, I think, are very, very wary of, you know, of exposing their children. What I did do was I talked about this with my daughter at an age, you know, she was 11 at the time. I don't think that what, at that time, I spoke to her about everything, what had happened, I know that she knew what was going on in some way, and I know that she had unanswered questions. I tried to answer them, but I think that when I did tell her everything, it didn't seem to come as a big surprise. And I felt then that I was glad that I had been honest with her, and it's my hope and belief that it will make her a sturdier adult. I think a lot of people grow up with horrible family secrets, you know, like this, you know, that they have to take with them into adulthood. They only discover it when they are adult. Then they can feel terribly betrayed by, you know, people that kept secrets. I've heard stories like this from friends of mine. So I decided to to do this. I felt that the story would be valuable to other women who were going through experiences like this. I've gotten many letters from readers, some men, in fact, who've been on the other side. And I do feel that my daughter is especially mature, and that we were able to have an open conversation, and I'm glad we did that.
Mm-hmm. I was curious how you wanted the reader to feel about Henry through this. I mean, he was a complicated character, and I could see why you were charmed, but so much of the time in reading the book, I'm going, I don't like this guy.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, what I wanted readers to see was the way in which, as a young woman, I mean, I was young when I met him, one can be charmed by that kind of person, very charismatic, seems to be, you know, on top of, you know, his game and all that. And I think that, unfortunately, women still are very, very seduced by those kinds of men, you know, that type.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly toward the end of my marriage, I had come to understand, we were not happy together, and I had certainly come to see the darker sides of all that without even knowing half of what had really been going on. But ultimately, I did love him. I know he loved me. He was a very, very flawed man. And where I hope readers find themselves is at the end is that they can find compassion for this man who I think did understand that he was flawed. If he did not understand how to repair his life, he certainly understood that he had caused damage.
Mm-hmm.
And that you would come to a place of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly where I came to.
Sure, sure. Did you, when you were writing, were you reading other memoirs, or what sort of things were you reading or studying, using to help you write your own work, if anything?
Oh, I read a lot. I would say that at that time when I was working, The Glass Castle had just come out.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helped me in terms of developing this opening, like understanding what a strong opening
mm-hmm.
is like.
Sure.
Mary Carr's The Liar's Club. So I did read a good Paula Fox's memoir about growing up. So I did read a good number of memoirs, but actually what I mostly read is fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that really, in a way, I thought what I've got here is a lot of plot, a lot of crazy plot. At one point I had thought of fictionalizing the whole thing, and I thought, no one will ever buy it because it's so far-fetched. So I thought, I need to tell it as it was, but I wanted to use the devices that a novelist might employ.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of how I saw, you know, saw the project.
Yeah, it seems that often the best memoirs do have sort of a novelistic feel to them in terms of, you know, in terms of structure. And if there are flashbacks, they're done in such a way that they really work within the book, lead into in a way that, you know, they're not just plunked in there because they need to be there. So, yeah, that's interesting.
I think reading fiction, can be very useful for a memoir writer. I really feel that, you know, that, you know, just really understanding how a great novel works could help you a lot.
Mm-hmm. And through the book, you also used Henry's emails. And mm-hmm. I was curious about that in terms of, you know, what point did you decide you were going to do that? How did you decide how many to use? You know, I mean, because I think that's a question that writers have in writing either memoir or, you know, writing about people that are in their lives, like what to use of theirs to show who they were.
Well, especially since Henry, you know, dies in the opening pages, I wanted to make sure that readers heard him,
mm-hmm.
heard his voice. And in my particular situation, because he had died and because I was the executor of his estate, I had inherited the copyright to use those emails. So that's one thing to make clear to people, is that in most cases you cannot use other people's emails without their consent. So I did actually retain a lawyer to determine what I could use and what I couldn't
use. So even if they're no longer living?
That is correct.
Interesting.
Their copyright, you know, the copyright would be inherited by their estate.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have to clear it with their estate. There's one person who gave me permission to use her emails. But, for example, Kathy, obviously, the mistress, my husband's main affair, certainly did not give me permission to use her responses
mm-hmm.
to my husband's emails, and therefore I could not use them.
Right.
What I was allowed to do was to paraphrase them.
Mm-hmm.
So I stuck very close, you know, absolutely to the limits of what I could use, but I felt that I didn't want to use too many of his emails. But I wanted to just give people a taste of how he talked and how he thought, and especially because what I wanted to show was that towards the end of his life, he really was in a kind of mental distress. I felt there's no better way to show that than in his own words.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting about how even if they're no longer living, how the emails still don't really belong to you, you know? I mean, it's unless you're the executor or executrix, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's something that if, you know, for people who are working on a memoir that does involve correspondence, you definitely have to make sure you have permission from whoever legally owns those,
mm-hmm.
those documents.
Yeah, interesting. I so appreciate your time here and you know, being with me for this half hour. And
my pleasure. Yeah,
thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
That was Julie Metz. Her book is Perfection, A Memoir of Betrayal and Renewal by Harper Perennial Voice. Beautiful cover, very striking cover. And I wanted to ask her about that, too, if she had anything to do with it, because she's an artist. But I didn't. So many questions go on unasked and unanswered. We're going to end now. I just want to remind you to go to penonfire.com, and there you can find out various things going on. There's a writer's salon next week coming up, next Tuesday night here in Orange County, California, with Claire Bidwell Smith. Her new memoir is The Rules of Inheritance. James Brown, who was on the show, and Dinah Lenny, who was also on the show. Actually, Claire was on the show, too. You could probably find all of their podcasts on the show on writersonwriting.blogspot.com. And next Tuesday night should be a wonderful night with three memoirists and a small venue where you can ask questions, get your book signed, and have a nibble and a drink and have a good time. So until next time, thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine.